and who want that hope to energize them toward justice, usually need something more practical than religion, although it could be an outgrowth of religion. They need this-worldly movements that give them a sense of solidarity in a good cause. King knew that one of the great dangers for African Americans in racist America was despair. His movement beckoned to such people, "Join us in pursuit of our dream." The women's movement, the gay rights movement, all have brought people formerly isolated into community around a set of goals, fostering hope. As King knew well, movements come in many forms. His own hopeful nonviolent movement contended against the retributive and potentially violent movement of Malcolm X. Gandhi, similarly, contended against ideas of violent retribution advocated by the Hindu right. He was assassinated by a member of that movement who believed that Gandhi had emasculated Hindu men by his opposition to retributive violence. Similar struggles have occurred in most large protest movements. As with religion, then, so here, we should endorse not the genus, but the hope-oriented and reconciliation-oriented species. I think for the most part, the Black Lives Matter movement has followed King. But there are segments that tend in the Malcolm X direction, and those do not foster hope or reconciliation. Similarly, the women's movement contains voices that demonize other feminists and seek to deny them a chance to speak, alongside more Socratic and inclusive voices. The gay rights movement has had some moments of hatred, but on the whole, has been exemplary for its unwavering defense of love against hate. The public celebration of love after the Orlando massacre, as hundreds of gays, lesbians, and friends and supporters turned out in the streets of Orlando to memorialize the dead, and to show that love is more powerful than hatred, is a vivid example of the way in which group membership can buttress hope. Some movements toward justice are nationwide. Many more are local. Grassroots organizing is perhaps one of our country's greatest and perennial resources in combating fear and despair, and feeding hope. Practices of hope, accounts of justice. People who hope for the future of their country need to have a vision of the goal for which they are striving. But it's a good idea to have more than a poetic vision. Here's another place where philosophy comes in handy in democratic life. Ever since Plato wrote The Republic, philosophers have created accounts of the just society, producing detailed arguments for these accounts and showing how a particular picture of the good or just society and its laws follows from assumptions that most people appear to accept. By now we have a wide variety of such accounts, of many different types. Communitarian, Marxist, authoritarian, and liberal social democratic, and liberal libertarian. For us in our time, although there is always much to be learned from theories that are radically different, what we need will be a theory that supports some type of liberal democracy. Liberal in the sense of allowing ample freedoms of speech, press, and religion, and democracy in the sense of rule by the people, though this clearly doesn't rule out a large role for courts and administrative appointees, more indirectly accountable to the people. But there are many different pictures of the just, liberal democratic state. And another thing liberal education often provides is the chance to understand, analyze, and debate these theories with other students. We should provide more public spaces where adults can do this too. Theories differ greatly about what rights all citizens have. Do these include social and economic rights, such as the right to health care? About the right account of ownership and redistribution, How much taxation, for example, is compatible with a due respect for ownership? And about the more precise definition of freedoms of religion, speech, and press, which our own Supreme Court constantly debates. One theory among others is the capabilities approach to defining justice that I have worked on for years, co-founding an international association to promote further study and implementation. The basic idea of this approach is to define basic human entitlements in terms of the idea of capabilities, or real opportunities that all citizens must have, up to some acceptable threshold level, if the society in question is to count as even minimally just. I then attempt to justify a list of 10 central capabilities that can be more concretely defined in each society. Here's the current list. The central capabilities. 1. Life. Being able to live to the end of a human life of normal length, not dying prematurely or before one's life is so reduced as to be not worth living. 2. Bodily health. Being able to have good health, including reproductive health, to be adequately nourished, to have adequate shelter. 3. Bodily integrity. Being able to move freely from place to place, to be secure against violent assault, including sexual assault and domestic violence, having opportunities for sexual satisfaction, and for choice in matters of reproduction. 4. Senses, imagination, and thought. Being able to use the senses to imagine, think, and reason, and to do these things in a truly human way, a way informed and cultivated by an adequate education, including, but by no means limited to, literacy and basic mathematical and scientific training. Being able to use imagination and thought in connection with experiencing and producing works and events of one's own choice, religious, literary, musical, and so forth. Being able to use one's mind in ways protected by guarantees of freedom of expression with respect to both political and artistic speech, and freedom of religious exercise. Being able to have pleasurable experiences and to avoid non-beneficial pain. 5. Emotions. Being able to have attachments to things and people outside ourselves. To love those who love and care for us, to grieve at their absence. In general, to love, to grieve, to experience longing, gratitude, and justified anger. Not having one's emotional development blighted by fear and anxiety. Supporting this capability means supporting forms of human association that can be shown to be crucial in their development. 6. Practical reason. Being able to form a conception of the good and to engage in critical reflection about the planning of one's life. This entails protection for the liberty of conscience and religious observance. 7. Affiliation. A. Being able to live with and toward others, to recognize and show concern for other human beings, to engage in various forms of social interaction, to be able to imagine the situation of another. Protecting this capability means protecting institutions that constitute and nourish such forms of affiliation, and also protecting the freedom of assembly and political speech. B. Having the social basis of self-respect and non-humiliation. Being able to be treated as a dignified being, whose worth is equal to that of others. This entails provisions of non-discrimination on the basis of race, sex, sexual orientation, ethnicity, caste, religion, national origin. 8. Other species. Being able to live with concern for and in relation to animals, plants, and the world of nature. 9. Play. Being able to laugh, to play, to enjoy recreational activities. 10. Control over one's environment. A. Political. Being able to participate effectively in political choices that govern one's life. Having the right of political participation, protections of free speech and association. B. Material. Being able to hold property, both land and movable goods, and having property rights on an equal basis with others. Having the right to seek employment on an equal basis with others. Having the freedom from unwarranted search and seizure. In work, being able to work as a human being, exercising practical reason and entering into meaningful relationships of mutual recognition with other workers. The focus is on capabilities rather than actual functioning because the theory gives great importance to choice. People may choose to fast for religious reasons when ample food is available, but there is a great difference between fasting and starving. I think this theory is a good basis for constitutional principles. On some issues, especially the rights of people with disabilities, I've argued that it does better than John Rawls's famous theory, which is extremely powerful and distinguished across most of the terrain of justice. So when I hope, I don't simply hope for justice. I focus on a theory I've worked on over the years that has definite implications for what we should do, and I work to bring that about. Even though most people are obviously not professional philosophers, all people are well advised, I think, to study the theoretical alternatives and debate them, figuring out what account of the political goal they think best. Many Americans right now don't agree with my view, which they will see as resembling European-style social democracy, for example, in its idea that health care is a basic social right. And it is notable that in Germany, where I often visit, even leading conservative politicians urge the generous support not just for health care, but also for disability care and education. It's part of what they think being Christian Democrats means. To care for the weak and for the family. When I was once asked to advise a subcommittee of the German National Bundestag, or Parliament, on development policy, I found that both left and right had really thought about norms with considerable sophistication and nuance. The right wing had, if anything, a more deeply philosophical orientation, asking me questions about Aquinas and other texts in normative political theory. If Germany right now, as I believe, is one of the more fear-resistant and balanced nations in Europe, it may well be because instead of snarky backbiting, politicians on both sides actually sit down and think. I think it would be a good idea for all Americans, not just officials, but also voters, to figure out what they really do think about such matters prior to entering a contentious and difficult political debate. If hope focuses on a reasonably concrete picture of the just society, which one is prepared to defend with good arguments against alternative pictures, it is easier to advocate wisely for measures calculated to bring that goal about. And it is easier to see when compromises with the opposition are reasonable and when they jeopardize something intrinsic to justice itself. The imperative of national service. So far, I have talked about ways of American life that already exist, although they can and should become more robust. But there is a large problem in American life that these solutions do not address. We live apart from one another. Most Americans, at least outside large urban centers and often there, grow up in neighborhoods segregated by race and class. Gays and lesbians are now visible everywhere in American life, because that identity cuts across those divisions. The same is true of people with disabilities. I believe that daily contact is a huge reason for the progress made by both of these movements. No comparable progress is found with race or class. Gender is uniquely complex, since contact is intimate, but true equality requires a change in the family, a major part of most people's lives. A second huge problem is that Americans lack a sense of the common good. They all too often think in narcissistic terms, what's good for me and for my family? This is nothing new. Every democracy, both ancient and modern, has had to struggle against people's narrowness of vision and self-focus to create a meaningful narrative of common purpose. Some have done this through wars, but obviously that is not the most attractive way to come together or feel that we are all invested in one another. The two problems are connected. Because people don't meet one another across major divisions, they have a hard time thinking outside their economic or racial group toward a sense of common purpose. I believe that a mandatory program of youth national civil service addresses both of these problems in an attractive and indeed necessary way. Modeled on the civil service arm of Germany's former national service requirement, but entirely civil and for all young people, my program would enroll young people, preferably for 3 years, and send them to do work that urgently needs doing all over America. Elder care, child care, infrastructure work, but always sending people into different regions, both geographically and economically. I don't have a detailed plan. Some suitable entrepreneur needs to do it. And since it is now politically unpopular, the first thing must be to sell it to people. The idea that we owe our country some of our work and our time is a very compelling idea, if expressed well. The idea has roots in all the major religions and in secular ethics. In an era of shrinking government, we simply lack manpower to perform many essential services. The subtext of my idea is that young people would see the diversity of people in their country, as soldiers in World War II learned to do during their service. Only my young people would be trying to help, not to kill. In the course of those valuable acts of service, they would also know the country in a new way. Stigma is typically founded on lack of close association. That's why the stigma attaching to gays and lesbians has diminished so rapidly with the coming out of young people all over the country. Now that same destigmatizing needs to happen, or happen more, with race, class, and also age. People don't usually talk about national service because they assume it is politically impossible. But if people don't talk about it, it certainly won't be possible. So I put my cards on the table. Why bother with hope? Stoicism and cynicism are perennial threats for the hopeful. The cynic scoffs at the romantic dreams of hopers. Here I mean the word cynic in its contemporary sense. The ancient Greek and Roman cynics were close to the Stoics in their philosophical ideas. The Stoic is less openly hostile but shrinks back from the waters of life into an insular detachment. Stoics promise us inner peace, proud independence, and a lofty superiority to fortune. Cynics say the world just isn't worth that much anyway. Here I return to Cicero. His last work, On Duties, was written while he was moving from house to house in the country, trying to dodge assassins sent by Mark Antony, since Cicero was known to support the pro-republic, anti-empire conspiracy of Brutus and Cassius. The assassins caught up to him shortly after that, slitting his throat. In this work, addressed to his son, not an impressive young man but his more intelligent daughter, had recently died in childbirth. He defends the life of committed public service, with its hopes and its energetic efforts for the future. He admits that the detached, hope-free life has been chosen by the noblest and most distinguished philosophers and also certainly strict and serious men who could not bear the conduct of the people or their leaders. This sounds to me all too familiar. What they were after, he continues, is clearly appealing. They wanted the same thing kings do, to need nothing, to obey nobody, to enjoy their liberty, which is defined as doing as you like. Cicero is gentle with these people. He says that detachment from politics is understandable if people are in ill health, and even if they are immersed in some important intellectual pursuit. His best friend, Atticus, was one of those detached people, so he had to create escape routes to express his love of his friend. And Cicero knows well the pain of hopeful attachment. He often records in his letters his profound upset and grief about what he sees happening to the Roman Republic. The life of detachment is easier and safer. All the same, Cicero says, such people are guilty of what might be called passive injustice. The injustice that consists in not energetically pursuing justice, even when that is very difficult. They also lack generosity and greatness of spirit. They do not serve the public good. In effect, Cicero is agreeing with Kant. We ought to serve the public good, so we had better become people who can stand to do that. Not shrinking violets or the delicate, unworldly sort of philosopher. Throughout his all-too-short life, we see Cicero wrestling with his own fear, with fatigue, with stomach trouble, with the temptation to despair, and always coming out with renewed hope for committed service. It's partly about justice, but, as we understand when we read what he has to say about Rome, it's mostly about love.
The Monarchy of Fear. A Philosopher Looks at Our Political Crisis was written by Martha C. Nussbaum and read by Amanda Carlin with a preface read by the author. The preface was recorded by Eric Fay at UChicago Creative and directed by Louisa Solomon. Editing and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, Technical Director. The Monarchy of Fear, A Philosopher Looks at Our Political Crisis, is available in print from Simon & Schuster.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.